Welcome to another episode of the Untangling Web3 podcast. Today is going to be a quick fire, punchy recent news event, which is the Ethereum ETF approval by the SEC. This is quite important. Back in January, we spoke about the Bitcoin ETF approval and how monumental that was for the crypto space, but the Web3 space at large, especially in terms of institutional adoption. And now the Ethereum ETFs have been approved as well. So yeah, this episode, we're going to unpack what it means and what happened, you know, some of the chaos that actually went around this. How are you doing, Jack?
Yeah, not too bad. Thanks, Alex. It's nice to start the new era, right? Year two of a podcast, with some good news for the industry, I guess. And well, didn't exactly take a crystal ball, I don't think, but after the Bitcoin approvals that we previewed and reacted to in January, a lot of speculation was then, well, Ethereum's going to follow suit quite soon. I've even seen today people saying Solana's up next. So it seems like the Bitcoin ETFs have had this knock-on effect. So yeah, it's interesting. I think there are a few different points of difference to discuss with the Ethereum one. And obviously, as you said, the background to it is a little bit different this time because of the SEC's views. But yeah, I think this is going to be an interesting kind of quickfire one.
Yeah, let's go into some of the background. So just for people that aren't aware, an ETF is this exchange traded fund. It's basically a way for investors to get access to lots of different funds, be it stocks, bonds, blah, blah, blah. Very popular amongst investors because they allow you to diversify your portfolio, they give you access to liquidity, and it's lower cost typically than, say, going with mutual funds and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, ETFs, very boring financial tools to invest in lots of stocks.
Yeah, maybe just also worth reminding ourselves that there are two types of ETFs typically. So you get spot ETFs, which is what we're talking about with the Ethereum approvals and also the Bitcoin one in January. So spot ETFs give you exposure to the spot price, so basically the current trading price of the underlying asset, whereas futures ETFs, they give you exposure to futures contracts that speculate on future price. And the futures ETFs have been around for a little while now for Bitcoin and Ethereum, I think, and these new spot ETFs is the ones that everyone was clamoring after that we're now getting in 2024.
Yeah, exactly. So some of the background, if you're not aware of the space, effectively, we've been having this ongoing battle from, you know, the crypto, I guess.
Market. You say we.
I invest in it, so I'm part of it. We have been having this ongoing battle with the crypto community and the SEC, which is like the regulatory body for financial tools and financial mechanisms in the US. And yeah, some of the things around this were, they were initially, say, a year or two ago, trying to define Bitcoin and Ethereum as securities. And there was this whole palaver about, you know, what is a security and what is a commodity and is Bitcoin, are Bitcoin and Ethereum securities or commodities? The reason this matters is because if it's defined as a security, if they are defined as securities, then there's a lot stricter regulation about how they can be used, how they're taxed, all this kind of stuff. And the SEC came out quite big early on and said, we need really strict regulation around Bitcoin, Ethereum, and all these things. For reasons like market manipulation, they thought a lot of these things were Ponzi schemes and they were quite unregulated. There wasn't proper kind of KYC going into it. Surveillance wasn't possible. You know, all that stuff around these are used to fund terrorist organizations and just used for money laundering and drugs. And yeah, the other main thing I think was they wanted to protect investors because of this. They thought you don't want big players like BlackRock going into Bitcoin. Then all of a sudden there's a rug pull and Bitcoin price goes to zero and people lose billions, right?
Yeah, it kind of underscores that getting these ETFs over the line has a lot of regulatory concerns. You mentioned the kind of surveillance sharing agreements, and this is something that was a big aspect in the Bitcoin ETF. So I think in the end, they had to have surveillance sharing agreements, which is essentially for the providers of these funds to share information on the activity of them to other entities, right? So I think there's an agreement for some of the Bitcoin ETFs with the NASDAQ exchange, right? And that's intended to help avoid market manipulation, as you said. But yeah, and it's just very interesting, as you said, this whole backdrop of is Bitcoin, is Ethereum a commodity or is it a security? And yeah, it's kind of been more or less settled now, right? For Bitcoin, it's being treated as a commodity, but Ethereum is the one that's had this big cloud looming over it for many years. And the question is basically, does it satisfy the Howey test, right? Which is how you determine something's a security or not. So I think that's involves, from my memory, it's something like it involves an investment of money with the expectation of profit in a common enterprise and the profits that you get from that would be derived from a third party or a promoter. So essentially, on the surface, lots of those things, I mean, most crypto looks like it probably falls under that bracket. So that's why there's been a lot of nervousness, I think, around it for Ethereum.
I think even the Hairy test is kind of vague. It's not as black and white as yes, no with those things, right? But I think, you talked about Bitcoin. It's kind of been decided now that it's not a security. But there was a lot of kind of issues and commotion around this. Like early on in 2021, there was Bitcoin futures ETF. So you didn't actually hold the asset. These big funds didn't hold the asset. They could speculated on the price of Bitcoin futures contracts rather than holding the asset. And this was the kind of the set stage for a while until there was lawsuits brought in by Grayscale and other people trying to actually get actual spot ETFs to hold the asset itself. And the courts ruled, they were like, yeah, actually, there's no reason why you can't do this. The kind of the arguments you've given don't make sense. And the SEC had to kind of backtrack a lot. And then back in January 2024, everything got approved, the floodgates opened, and Bitcoin became institutionally adopted in a lot of ways. And yeah, that was the state of play up until recently. But like Jack said, this wasn't the case for Ethereum. There was still a lot of speculation as to whether Ethereum was a commodity, like Bitcoin was being defined now, or was it more of a security? And there was a lot of applications going in despite that. And I think up until recently, so we're in May 2024 now, I saw that Bloomberg prediction that the Ethereum ETFs were going to be approved was around 25%. Then literally overnight, it skyrocketed to 75%. And everyone was like, what the hell has happened? And we had a lot of SEC chaos because of it. And now we're in the stage where things have been approved.
I mean, if there's one thing you can say about the SEC's handling of all this stuff is that there's been mixed messaging, I think, to say the least, right, over time. And yeah, so this news that there are these kind of two different filing types, right? They have to make, you have to have a what's called a 19B4 form that gets approved. And that kind of is the basic, allows an issuer to go and list an ETF and be a custodian, et cetera, and set things up. And then you have the S1 form approval, which is what you need for the ETF to actually go live and be traded. So it was news that these 19B4 files, they were asking them to go and update them on an accelerated basis. Basically, you know, with hindsight, it looks like they were saying you want to get these approved as fast as possible. So can you go and sort things out? So yeah, that happened. We saw this big boost in the odds and the bookmakers. And interestingly, there was lots of kind of on-chain betting, which is quite funny. Interesting to see where the speculation is happening now, you know, beyond just speculation on the price of these assets. But then there was lots of on-chain betting markets that then suddenly started changing their odds quite drastically on there being an Ethereum ETF approval.
Yeah, Matthew Sigel, who's the head of digital asset research at VanEck, described this as one of the biggest regulatory 180s in SEC history, just to kind of highlight how abrupt this was out of nowhere. And obviously, Ethereum price spiked by 25% effectively overnight on the back of this. And like Jack said, this approval we've got so far is kind of like the high-level approval that we agreed that Ethereum can be listed in this way in these ETFs. And then there's a bit of devil in the detail around this SE1 approval stuff, which is like, okay, how actually does it work? Like, as in, there's a lot of things around, can you stake through these ETFs? And they're saying, okay, no, staking's prohibited for XY reasons. But yeah, so there is more work that needs to go on before these are fully approved and can be traded. But they've high level agreed that this will happen, basically. And there's one other thing that I want to give in the backdrop to this. So there's this FIT21 bill, which I think is a really funny name. It actually stands for Financial Innovation and Technology for the 21st Century, which is not as fun as FIT21 bill, that gives a little backdrop to this.
Yeah, exactly. And this was very interesting timing, let's say, with this was approved more or less kind of 5 or 6 days ago now. So this bill, it was being proposed and going through the House of Representatives in the US. It passed the vote last week. And I think there's some interesting political machinations going on between the two sides of Congress and of the political landscape in America generally with the upcoming elections. And eventually this was approved. It's significant because it's going to, as you said, provide significant regulatory clarity, not only hopefully eventually for the assets themselves, but also in the division of labor between the various organizations that are involved, right? So you have the SEC, which you'd think would be just handling securities, and the CFTC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which should be just handling the commodity side of things. Now, the issue being which crypto go in which buckets, right? But I think this is going to provide some clarity over, okay, which of these organizations are actually going to start targeting and looking at certain things. It's also meant to be providing other things like more detailed market structure for digital assets. So what issuers, what custody provisions you have. You spoke a lot about custody in recent episodes. Lots of those kind of considerations that people know about generally in the industry, but then they're going to be put into some more legislative clarity, right? And proper guidelines, I think, being accompanied with that.
Yeah, exactly. We're not going to go too much into this FIT 21 bill, but Jack gave like a really good high level. It effectively is a bill that provided more regulatory clarity, consumer protections, basically all the things you need for the US to move more heavily into a regulated crypto space. I think one of the interesting things around this was Biden previously said, I will veto this bill, no matter what, I will veto this bill. Probably because he didn't think there was much Democratic support for it. And then all of a sudden, there's this kind of cross-party support. The Democrats come out and they vote in favor of this bill. And he's now saying he won't veto it. So it was really this strange turn overnight, basically, over the course of a week, where there was positive support from Joe Biden, Democrats, legislators across the board. And we're going to go into some of the reasons why, because that all fits into why the Ethereum ETFs were approved as well, why there's been this change. But like I said, don't want to go too much into this FIT 21 bill. I think one part that I do want to highlight, which is quite interesting, is around this decentralization test, which, you know about this, Jack? I thought this was one of the most interesting parts of the entire bill.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this is kind of builds on some of the noises that have been made by the regulators. People like Hester Peirce, right, has been talking about decentralization and defining it in more detail for a number of years now. So they're basically saying, in order to classify one of these digital assets as a commodity, it needs to meet a kind of certain threshold for decentralization, which, you know, as we talked about in our episode on decentralization, it is a spectrum. So it's nice to see that they're acknowledging it. And I think it's something like no entity can have more than 20% control of the network. Is that right? To be considered sufficiently decentralized, I think.
That's so powerful. Like, it'd be interesting to work out why they came to that number. But like you say, this shows a real understanding of what decentralized means. Like, a lot of people were coming out and saying, okay, Ethereum shouldn't be considered a commodity because you have potentially this controlling organization that have a majority share or close to majority share that can manipulate the price or change the course of it and all this kind of stuff. And like you say, like, decentralization is such a kind of powerful word in the crypto space where everyone's vying to say they're the most decentralized. And when you look under the hood, a lot of them aren't. But it's really interesting that they've come out and actually defined what decentralization is.
Yeah, and I 100% agree with your point there, right? The number is really interesting, 20%. Like, why 20%? Is that the number that they've chosen? And I think it's very cautious on their part, and I think it's quite smart. So if you look at the theoretical side of decentralization, people would say, well, in Bitcoin, so long as no one has 51% of the network, then it's fine. It's decentralized. I mean, lots of people would disagree with that, but that's a theoretical argument you can make. In other corners, you might have, I've seen 33% is quite often touted, and there are other consensus mechanisms for other blockchains and other cryptos that have a scientific threshold on decentralization under which it's secure, which is more like 33%. And then they've gone one step further and said, no, let's say 20% is our limit, which is, you know, significantly lower. So I think they're hedging their bet. Well, I say hedging their bets. I think they're being cautious and saying, we really don't want to have any significant control of any entity in a network for it to be decentralized, which is a little bit interesting for the case of Ethereum. And they've said, I think that Ethereum does qualify under this potentially. But if you, I just had a quick look at Etherscan right this morning, and there's a block proposer called Beaver Build that is sitting around 41% of blocks mined in the last 24 hours, taking around 50% of the rewards of the network, right? And this isn't complete, again, it's not black and white at all, because it's a block proposer, which is just one part of the whole consensus mechanism and validation system in Ethereum. But it does show that there are still entities with influence in certain elements that go above that 20% threshold. So I'm interested to see whether that will impact them going forward.
And yeah, I do want to talk about this more, because like you say, these are dynamic things. Like, mining percentage could change potentially overnight. Like, how can you keep changing between security and commodity? But before we go into that, should we talk about, you know, some of the reasons that people are speculating there was this drastic U-turn basically overnight? I think they are quite interesting, and it kind of reflects mostly like politics in America for for obvious reasons. So yeah, one of the big reasons that this U-turn happened was around legal pressure. Like the SEC was facing basically repeated legal cases against them to say, okay, why aren't you filing these things? What's the actual reasoning behind a lot of this stuff? And I think they just didn't necessarily have the means to fight all these cases. I looked at some of the numbers that were being thrown around to actually keep pushing like some of the SEC's legal battles, and it was like in the hundreds of millions, like really crazy, wow, crazy numbers to keep fighting this stuff.
Yeah, it's crazy the stakes that we're talking about now in these legal decisions. And, you know, we spoke before about, I don't know if maybe this is the ones you've looked at, but with Coinbase's position, they're actively reaching out, trying to talk to the regulators. There's all these different fronts on which the SEC and to a lesser extent, probably the CFTC are fighting or dealing with at the minute. So just even not even from a cost perspective, but just from a manpower and brain power perspective, it must be impossible to keep on top of if you're in one of those organizations right now.
Yeah, and I think that the other side of that is that there's a lot of money in crypto now. So they have the money to actually fight these cases. It's not something you necessarily want to go up against when there's trillion-dollar businesses on the line potentially. And these matter so much more for the, say, the crypto players than they do for the SEC. So they're going to put so much into this. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic. The other big one is the politics, obviously. We've seen that there's been a kind of a transition from, say, I don't know, both the Republican and the Democratic side for more crypto pro stance, right? And this has come because we're in an election year. Like maybe you've seen Donald Trump has come out very strong on crypto side saying, you know, I will protect your rights to custody of digital assets. I'll protect your right to trade crypto and all this kind of stuff. I think maybe it's in part because he's trying to generate a lot of revenue from his new NFT collection to fight some of those legal battles he's got going on right now.
Yeah, there's a myriad reasons why this could be the case. I mean, the last US presidential election in, 2020, I remember how notable it was that there was basically one major candidate. I think it was a Democratic candidate. I forget his name now, but he was campaigning on a very pro-crypto ticket, right? And he was probably the only one. He was very kind of tech-focused, young, kind of looking forward basically in the industry. And now that's much more commonplace, right? You've got lots more candidates on both sides of the spectrum in US politics who are now looking at being pro crypto. And maybe it's the impact of meme coins. You know, all jokes aside, there have been a lot of meme coins bleeding into the political sphere this year to do with the major candidates. But also I think it's very clear that there's now a growing mandate for the general widespread use of crypto. I think it's the mayor of Miami has basically been on a singular one-man mission to make it the state for the home for crypto. I know Texas has also has been working to bring a lot of innovators in there. So there are lots of, you know, not just on the federal level in the US, but there's lots of infighting to position within the US as the home for crypto now, which is very interesting.
Yeah, it's quite exciting for the space. On that meme stuff, I saw that Joe Biden for his campaign is hiring, I think it's something like director of memes or something like that. Who's going to, like, their whole job is to like develop memes and put it on social media to get him going. It's just crazy to see how politics is trying to keep up with modern day tech culture and like social media specifically.
Yeah, and on the politics point, I think it is just worth a very brief mention of Sam Bankman-Fried, because, you know... Now he's obviously, I believe, serving a jail term, right? We discussed before. But one of the big things about the whole FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried debacle was that he was a heavy political donor, right? And potentially to both sides, because he was, as we spoke about, so deep into influencing regulation, kind of a one-man lobbyist almost. So it's very interesting to see that lots of people are still pro-crypto, despite maybe having been tainted indirectly or directly by what happened with Sam. So yeah, that's just one thing I think is worth mentioning as we lead up to the election.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump is accepting crypto donations on Coinbase, so he's like got his finger in all pies, obviously. And like you say, I think it was a surprise that this FIT21 bill, there was a lot of Democratic support, cross-party support, so Joe Biden's recognized that. He doesn't want to lose that sector society that now sees Donald Trump as the pro-crypto stance, so he's trying to go into that, even if it maybe is against some of his principles. I think the other big person we've got to speak about here is Gary Gensler, obviously, who is just a bit all over the place, I think, when it comes to this stuff. Like, I've seen a lot of people saying, like, he just thinks Donald Trump is going to get elected, sees that Donald Trump is very heavy on the pro-crypto side and doesn't want to get fired when Donald Trump comes in. So he's changed his tune basically overnight. But that's all speculation.
Yeah, speaking of memes, the gift that keeps on giving. I'm quite kind of sympathetic in a way with Gary Gensler because he's had a tough job and he's the figure of a lot of derision now. But yeah, I think he has had a pretty strong 180 himself. Really, people talk about the SEC and a lot of the time they're referring to Gary Gensler anyway. So yeah, this may well be a move of pragmatism for the next political regime. And it'll be very interesting to see where it's left at the end of this year, right? If there, as you say, if there is a turnover in personnel at these organizations, if there is a completely new kind of philosophy instilled at them, I can't imagine that these organizations are prone to such sweeping changes you get in politics, because then it would be complete chaos. But it's pretty chaotic anyway, so maybe it will, who knows.
Yeah, and the last two kind of like external dynamics that I want to talk about really quickly is we have this SAB 121 bill, and this was effectively a bill that required banks to hold customers' digital assets on their balance sheets, which was a bit burdensome for banks. So they kind of limited, say, people's ability to do that. And there's been a resolution to overturn that to make it much easier for banks to allow consumers to hold digital assets. That's one piece that I want to talk about that's also fed into this kind of positive crypto outlook being pushed in kind of the legislative space. And the other one is this anti-CBDC bill, which I think is really interesting. Like, for whatever reason, America is really, I've seen it, like, noticed it a lot on social media. Like, Americans are really worried about CBDCs generally. They think it's a way for, say, the Federal Reserve to dominate the kind of their financial instruments, especially when online. They think it's a threat to privacy. They think governments are going to increase control. And I don't know if it feeds into this kind of like American idea of freedom, liberty, you know, privacy, all this kind of stuff. But people are really coming out against that. And there's actually been an anti-CBDC bill that's been passed in the House, which feeds into this whole kind of crypto play as well. If you want the efficiency of crypto and this decentralized ability to interact peer-to-peer and you don't want to do it with the CBDC, well, that obviously feeds quite positively into the Bitcoins, the Ethereums of the world.
Yeah, you're right. This is a really interesting one. And I agree with your analysis that it probably is that a case of CBDCs, I think, are going to be a hard sell to a lot of the American public, given the American dream, the idea of complete freedom in the market and people wanting to have more autonomy over their money and things like that. And even though we've discussed there are a million different ways to implement CBDCs and there are a million different properties you get out of those choices, I think the perception is still so great, especially in places like America, that this is the way for the state to get into your wallet, basically, and to have controls. And following the COVID kind of parachute payments and the inflation that we've seen, the money printing, you know, that's another meme. Printer go burr. That's one of the big big memes we've seen over the last few years. I think that's probably fed into this. But as you said, this does position the US to be much more pro-crypto native, because the demand is there overall for digital money. And if they're not going down the CBDC route, that means they necessarily have to be a little bit more pro-actual blockchain infrastructure, right? The real stuff that we talk about all the time. So yeah, I think this could end up being a positive thing, even though maybe they're throwing out the baby with the bathwater a little bit on CBDCs.
God, we've not heard that phrase in a long time. I'm glad it's made a return. Yeah, I think, like, we talked about this early on in, say, normal legislators and, say, government representatives' misunderstanding of the crypto space and thinking, I can turn off Bitcoin, I can turn off Ethereum. It's like, no, you really can only turn off the access to Bitcoin and Ethereum if you really want to. And it's nice to see that they've slowly started to understand that pushing this away through legislation to other countries is just going to lead to a lack of innovation and a lack of revenue for their own country. And Trump is obviously pushing that agenda, saying we want business here, we want the crypto natives to be here building, because that's what America's about. And it seems like Joe Biden's now had to do a U-turn to make sure he's not lacking in that space, basically.
Yeah, I think, yeah, this is one that we definitely will check in on in a few months, if not towards the end of the year, because it will be very different to see what the noises are coming out of the regulators in a post-2024 election world in the US. But yeah, not to make this too much of a political cast, right? So I think that's well covered by other shows. But maybe if we just finally end the show and return to what do we actually think the impact of these ETF approvals are for Ethereum then? So we've covered the fact that, you know, this will provide additional regulatory oversight potentially, and this is a signal of increased adoption, which we can get into. But I think the big question I have, and that I'm a little bit uncertain on, is do you think this will change the view on Ethereum, because let's say the default right now, I think, is to say Ethereum is probably more likely a security if you go on what has been said by Gary Gensler and the SEC. Do you think this will move the needle and push into a commodity area, or do you think this doesn't change anything? So I think that's the big question that comes from this.
I think that based on that speculation as to what decentralization is and therefore what is a security and what is a commodity, I think networks will really be looking to decentralize. And I think the big push, just purely for like tax reasons, the burden reasons, whatever it is. And I think what will be interesting is there'll be a real push to create better incentives for miners so that more people go into that space right now. And I think that's what we're going to see from networks is, how do we incentivize miners to come into this network so we can define it as more decentralized? And that's what I think will the angle will be from a technical and a kind of strategic perspective for these networks going forward.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty kind of strong conclusion to draw. And I'd agree with that. I think the reason I asked partly is because I've seen a lot of talking heads saying, well, this signals Ethereum going down the same path as Bitcoin, and it's definitely going to become a commodity, not a security. And I find that a bit of a strange one to jump to, because all we're saying really is that they're going to allow these Ethereum ETFs, these spot ETFs, which are themselves securities, right? So if you have a share in an ETF, mm-hmm. that is a security. So we're talking about the approval of a security that's linked ultimately to Ethereum. Maybe you could contort it to think, well, actually, this is getting people used to the idea of Ethereum as a security. So I just wanted to point out that I think a lot of people are maybe getting ahead of themselves when they think this is going to completely flip how people view Ethereum. But yeah, that's my two cents.
No, that makes sense. I don't think this is that impactful a thing for, say, the actual details, the technical aspects of Ethereum, or, you know, I don't even think the taxation stuff matters too much. I think what it is, just a nod towards, this is the space to push towards. And like we said, that we prioritize utility over speculation. And I think more people will be looking at and putting money into this space. What are the dApps that I can start to build? And I think that's the most exciting thing, is we kind of said that Bitcoin in its implementation right now isn't known for supporting this kind of absolute utopia of dApps, right? Because of maybe the misconception, there's an inability to do smart contracting. And for whatever reason, Ethereum is that place. Like, it is the world computer that has the best ecosystem for building decentralized application. I think the exciting thing is now the money that's going to come to that space. I imagine there will be a boom in investment looking for, how can I improve the technology to support other people coming into that space? And even though this isn't that monumental a thing, like you say, I think in 5 to 10 years, people will now be looking to the horizon. Okay, in 5 to 10 years, it will be a monumental thing. And this is the path going towards that.
Yeah, I agree. And if you think of Ethereum as having more utility than BTC, for example, then until now, it was harder to access any potential price upside that comes from that for the general retail consumer, right? And I think this is good because it evens the playing field out between a BTC and an Ethereum. And it says, well, if the utility narrative around Ethereum is valid and if it continues, then people can get price exposure to that. And Ethereum isn't limited by the lack of market access that it had compared with Bitcoin, right? Having its ETF approvals in January. So in just terms of its direct impact, I think it's good that at least we have those two on a level footing now that they can compete on in the wider market, I think.
And I think, like, we talk about blockchains and like cryptocurrencies that enable blockchains and all this kind of stuff, and there's a lot of value to be derived from that transparency, data, all this kind of stuff. But the fundamental thing that I think we've been missing, that is, the in my mind, the USP of all this stuff, is the idea to embed data and value into one exchange, for example. And the point right now is we don't do that because not many people, or the general market, doesn't want to transact in Ethereum. Like, you have micropayments. That was one of the primary goals in my mind of Bitcoin, but that doesn't work. There's a lot of reasons why that doesn't work, but it fundamentally also doesn't work because people don't want to transact in Bitcoin. You give me Bitcoin for some micro reward or micro incentive, I can't use it down the markets. Like, I just hold it in my Coinbase wallet and maybe trade it out after a week or something like that. But I think the idea that we can start to use cryptocurrencies for everyday payments in supermarkets as actual real, you know, currency and real kind of cash, that really excites me. And that's the kind of, I think that's when we're going to see the real value add of all these cryptocurrencies, when we can actually use them for everyday payments and embed all the other functionality we've talked about with, like, you know, data immutability, transparency, peer-to-peer, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, you've actually maybe had a thought there that these new financial instruments that we're getting that give people price exposure, maybe we'll end up segregating the speculation to these regulated financial instruments. Mm. And then the people who are wanting to build, wanting to do this exciting stuff, try micropayments, build applications on Ethereum, whatever it might be, they'll be the ones who are actually self-custodying and handling these things themselves. And there are pros and cons to both. But I think it's nice to now, you, before, price exposure and utility were all in the same bucket, basically. But now with these instruments, you can segregate it a little bit. So you can, I could put some money away in my retirement account that has exposure to one of these ETFs. And then I can also have some in my wallet to go and play, you know, some Web3 game with, right? Which is cool. I like that. It means we have more options at the end of the day.
Yeah. So just to summarize that, the high level benefits are increased institutional interest, which is good for, you know, financing a lot of these real utility projects. Market reaction, obviously, Ethereum went up 25% basically overnight, which is always nice, and better regulatory clarity in the space, basically. And you know, so another interesting kind of, as soon as this happened, like within a day, I was seeing articles everywhere about, okay, Solana and XRP are the next to be approved, everyone buy right now. And so I think they went up maybe as much as Ethereum did, just people were like, you know, in a year's time these will be approved, and there's all the value has already been locked up into Ethereum, and these announcements were already assumed. And I'm like, what, was it really, like, it was only like a day ago that everyone was saying it wasn't going to happen?
Yeah, it's crazy how quickly people jump onto it. I think it's a bit like listings on exchanges. This is what that kind of used to be. It was like, oh, well, I would get this crypto because if that's been listed, then this might be listed. And now we're talking about something with much higher regulatory burden on it, right, to get a listed, an ETF. I think it could be a number of years away for some of these, especially for the newer chains or the ones, you know, you mentioning Solana as a potential candidate. Well, that has significant downtime quite frequently, right? So that has its whole other set of challenges. Maybe that won't meet the requirement of a commodity, right? Why is my commodity down, right? Like gold doesn't go down, that kind of thing. So I think there are different questions to ask. And another implication we didn't quite touch on yet is the fact that we now have, you know, this instrument for an ETF, both for a proof of work, or the biggest proof of work blockchain and the biggest proof of stake blockchain, right? So now, again, they're both on a level footing in terms of market access, potentially. But how will this change in terms of the narrative, maybe over the next few years? Will this impact the staking paradigm you have on Ethereum, which you don't really have on proof of work? And, you know, will these big financial institutions who are locking up assets? And again, when you think of someone like a BlackRock, right, they had to buy a lot of Bitcoin to support their ETF. If they then, you know, a Vanguard goes and buys a bunch of Ethereum to support their Ethereum ETF, then they can do something more with that. They can go and stake that, right? And how does that play into their obligations as a custodian? I'm not quite sure, but it'd be interesting to know.
I think this is one of the most interesting points. Like, you have proof of work, where effectively the miners who, they run the network at the end of the day, they have massive heavy bits of kit that are very expensive to run, that people don't really want to be involved with unless they absolutely have to be, and that is their entire business portfolio. They run the network. So BlackRock coming in and buying whatever it is, 100 million of Bitcoin, or holding 100 million of Bitcoin for their consumers, doesn't really affect that too much. Obviously, you can say they have indirect sway. If they start saying, come on, can you do this thing, then they'll listen because they have a lot of the activity on the network. It's very different with a proof of stake network. The network is effectively dominated or run by the amount of stake you put in, which is the amount of Ethereum you hold. And yeah, there's some mining equipment you need, but it's insignificant to the amount of stake you need. So if you then have a BlackRock that now owns, say, 15% of the network, for example, or has 15% of the stake, and they're like, actually, you know what? We can just spend 100 grand, buy a mining rig, and I could be a dominant player in this space. It really feeds into that kind of, we talked about decentralization earlier and what is decentralized. But if you all of a sudden have these ETFs that make up, say, 40% of the network, there might be a real centralization there of all this stuff. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out with the proof of stake network.
Yeah, that'd be really ironic if one of the Ethereum ETF custodians ends up accumulating so much Ethereum and they think, why don't I stake it as a validator? And then there's some changes with other validators, and all of a sudden one of these crosses that 20% threshold and brings it out of a commodity into a security domain. That would be interesting, right? That would be one impact of all this approval down the line that they maybe weren't foreseeing.
What would they do? What they would probably do is split it up into two entities and then start saying, okay, we've got 15% here, 15% there. And then you're like, okay, so how do we really define decentralization? Because these are separate legal entities, but there's a connection there where they have similar motives. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see how they start to define decentralization. I've seen like a lot of these networks have 1,000 mining nodes and stuff like that. And when you, they all have different names, and you look under the hood, and it's all run by, you know, two companies. You're like, that's not decentralized. Like, it's technically maybe decentralized, but like philosophically and politically, whatever it is, that's not decentralized. But really interesting to see how they start to regulate this across the crypto networks.
Yeah, and I haven't actually read the detail of the FIT bill yet, but I definitely intend to. I'd be interested to know how concrete the definition of the entities they're talking about are, right? One entity having control. Because you have this question in Bitcoin with mining pools right now. Right? We have, you know, potentially tens of thousands of people contributing hash power, but really you have one controlling entity that's proposing the next block. As we said in Ethereum, you have these block proposers, these validators, and kind of a few other types in between. If one of them has 40%, like we mentioned earlier, does that tip them into having a controlling stake or controlling influence in the network or not? So yeah, I don't know, are these decentralization terms in the bill even fit for purpose yet? I don't know, but definitely one for me to read up on and maybe come back to you with a hot take next time.
Yeah, but I think overall this news is exciting. Like, the SEC have basically signed off that these ETFs can go ahead. That looks good for the market. Obviously number goes up, but you can't actually trade it until these S1 filings get approved. And I'm quite interested, maybe more interested, to see what they look like, because that's where the devil in the detail is. I've seen already they're saying that you won't be able to stake with these ETFs. There'll be lots of kind of prohibitions on them, and they'll be quite limited in the first iteration. But yeah, let's wait to see if and when they get approved and what it actually looks like for people.
Yeah, we said with the Bitcoin ETFs, there was this interesting kind of clause in there about them being able to define what they think Bitcoin is. And Ethereum also has this history of forking, right? We have Ethereum Classic and normal Ethereum. So how will that play in? How will they cater for potential future upgrades and future forks of Ethereum that we can't foresee now? That'll be, like, as you say, the devil will be in the detail. But yeah, I think that kind of more or less wraps up our reaction to this news. Again, significant, but lots of regulatory clarity pending. Hopefully will come very soon. So yeah, with that, we'll just say thank you for listening wherever you may be. And join us next time to untangle a little more Web3.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.